With news headlines consistently sharing stories about billion-dollar disasters, the world can feel like a scary place for homeowners. Most places are vulnerable to one or more natural hazards, leaving homeowners to face uncertainty about how to build, insure, and prepare for threatening conditions. Hey everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast. GeoTrek explores the world to tell stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We focus on the physical processes behind such extreme events, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of such events to reduce the loss of life and property. If you come to the podcast with questions about how to make your home more resilient from natural disasters, you're going to absolutely love this episode. Our special guest, Leslie Chapman Henderson, is president and CEO of the Federal Alliance for Safe Homes, or FLASH. Leslie is passionate about empowering homeowners to make proactive decisions to prepare their homes for whatever natural hazards threaten, whether wind, flood, fire, or earthquake. The cost of this podcast is free, but we do ask that you share it with someone who is building or buying a new home, as well as friends and family who could benefit from making their home safer. Well, without further introduction, welcome to GeoTrek Podcast number 98, Federal Alliance for Safe Homes with Leslie Chapman Henderson. Leslie, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek Podcast.
My pleasure.
Leslie, you're such a powerhouse in disaster resiliency. I have to ask you, how in the world did you get involved in this career path?
Well, thanks for asking. There is always a backstory to how we all join the movement, which we consider disaster resilience absolutely a movement because we're striving for better buildings that withstand whatever type of disaster is out there. In my own personal story, I grew up on the East Coast of the U.S., the Delmarva, Maryland, Virginia, D.C., and then migrated when my father moved us down to Florida. So I had a lot of hurricane experience growing up. Remember making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and sitting around in the dark playing cards with the family, but just really being aware. My parents were very sensitive. My dad was an engineer, and being very sensitive to the storms. And then later in life, one of my first jobs, I worked overseas on an airbase in the Middle East for the Air Force, and I got very sensitized and exposed to earthquakes. We had a couple earthquakes in southeastern Turkey. And unfortunately, it was before the Republic of Turkey instituted building codes. So we had a total collapse of our cabinetry, lost all my wedding china, which is really all I owned at the time. So I had that sensitivity. And then our next assignment with the military was California, where I was walking along, felt the earth shake and thought, what the heck? So I really became sensitized when I was young, and then I realized there were all different kinds of disasters, and I just got into it. So then I came back to the States, moved back to Florida, and went into the insurance industry. And I realized that there were both financial and physical ways to protect people from disasters. And I think that's how, you know, when I left the industry after 12 years, that's how I really enjoyed the idea of prevention. And getting people, you know, just equipping them with information, because that's what this is all about. Giving people information before the event so that they're safe. First and foremost, we can save, and I believe we have saved lives. And then also helping them protect their most significant investment, which is their home. And, you know, to your point, it's not something that you grow up and take the course track in college to do, but it is something that is so rewarding. And we need more people in this field because it's just a little, we're doing well, but we can do even better.
Yeah, Leslie, I've heard you speak. You have a lot of passion, but beyond that, you have a lot of empathy for people. And this makes sense, the fact that you've lived in a lot of disaster prone places, the East Coast of the U.S. with the hurricane threat, Turkey, California, these places with earthquake threats. I found for professionals that have actually lived in disaster prone places, it becomes more personal to them, right? They've actually seen people, their friends and neighbors and community impacted. This kind of helps me connect some dots here and understand why you're so passionate about this and have a lot of empathy as well.
Oh, thanks. Well, in my first wave of activity, I was in the insurance industry for 12 years. And my first role after going through some management training, I was in claims and catastrophe response in particular. And there's nothing that embeds this in your heart and soul more than holding hands and having your arms around the shoulders of somebody as you look at their home that's been destroyed in a hurricane or a flood or any other event. And you see the impacts and how it changes people's lives. And the insurance industry does a great job of making people whole financially. But that check that you hand out is step one on what is often a years-long journey to recover. Those recoveries take years. And sometimes emotionally, people never fully recover. And anything we can do, anything our organization does to empower people and remove fear and make them realize that it's not hopeless and it's not just luck. And that's just something I'll never forget. Some of my experiences, I think my most seminal event as an insurance industry professional in response was Hurricane Andrew. And I worked with people, met families from all over. One family in particular was from Nicaragua, and they had been through the earthquakes and moved to South Florida and lost their home in the hurricane. And we talked about her son who was in kindergarten in his race car bed. And he just trying to explain to him why he couldn't sleep in his race car bed anymore, you know. So those are the things that really drive us forward and help us stay the course when it comes to really pushing for the things that make home strong.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just seeing those personal impacts. And I know the work that you and your team are doing there with the Federal Alliance for Safe Homes, or FLASH, I think really, you know, you're engaging at a national level, but also at a regional, local, and community level as well. And so that's encouraging to hear that you're out there in the communities, that you're engaging with these people and understanding the impacts of the storms on them. I wanted to ask if you could kind of give us a background about FLASH. I mean, just a background on the organization. How did it get started and really get to be where it is today?
Sure. So in the years following Hurricane Andrew, in the immediate aftermath, as a member of the insurance industry, we created a coalition of stakeholders and organizations that was the National Hurricane Center, emergency management at the state and federal level, the corporate sector, the building code universe, and others. We all came together and we started having weekly recovery meetings. And we talked about, everyone had their specific and well-defined role. You know, the Hurricane Center got back to doing the next forecast and the next weather forecast. And everyone had a role. And the question that kept bubbling up in that setting was, who is taking on the issue of whether or not we're going to build back differently so that we can get a better result next time? And that was the organizing question that created FLASH. FLASH started out as the Florida Alliance for Safe Homes. And we were just a committee. And the committee was formed to see who could take on this idea of sea change and directional change and breaking the cycle of build, destroy, rebuild the same way. And that's where we started. So the committee was hurricane only, Florida only. It became very clear that we'd identified a gap that we could fulfill by providing information to homeowners, elected officials, and others in charge of building codes. And then in 1997, the state of Florida basically caught fire. The wildfire federal disasters were declared in all 67 counties. And so we realized we needed to expand our portfolio to include multi-hazard, hurricane, wildfire, flood, whatever the homeowner and the family and the local leader was confronting, we wanted to provide them the excellent research and engineering information, the building science, to make good choices to build strong communities. And then other governors, Governor Bush was here in Florida at the time, and he shared our story with many of his peers across the country. And with the insurance commissioner leadership group and the governors, we start expanding across the U.S. And today we work very closely. FEMA has been at our table from inception. They're a founding and legacy partner. And FEMA Building Science in particular, we've had a 26-year run together. So through them, we provide information across the U.S., but also the American territories. And places as far away as Guam and American Samoa. And then through our hurricane and Hurricane Center NOAA partnerships to the World Meteorological Organization, we provide information through to the Caribbean, the United Nations, and others. So we have a lot of good info in a lot of languages.
Yeah. Leslie, could you share some insights in like the mission of Flash today? And then like, has that changed a lot since those early days coming out of Hurricane Andrew in 1992?
So we've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to articulate our mission. It's strengthening homes and safeguarding families from disasters of all kinds. And I'm happy to say the mission has never changed. What's changed is the sophistication of how we accomplish our mission, the kinds of programs we do. We target any and all audiences that will hear us, whether it's, you know, kids, school, engineering classes, certified courses for builders, however we deliver, we are trying to make that home stronger. We do support building codes that are for commercial structures, but generally speaking, our commercial structures are individually engineered and stronger to begin with. So the weak link in how our communities hold up in disasters are residences. And that's why we still target those primarily to this day. We couple and align our information always with safety information. Many of our partners, their primary purpose is safety information. So we provide that extra piece for the strengthening of the home. And then we reinforce the safety information. In some cases, we bring our own unique safety programs to bear as well.
Leslie, what impressed me really hearing you speak at multiple conferences, you just want to get the message out. It doesn't even necessarily need to be your credit or your message. You're happy to partner with anyone that'll invite you to a meeting or partner or help you get the message out. Could you talk about some of these amazing partnerships that you've developed over the years?
Our partners basically are the reason we are successful, because Flash is a partnership, and we recognize every time we work on an issue or we look at a challenge and we try to develop messaging, we recognize that the audience has a preferred deliverer of a message, right? And so instead of trying to brand our organization in a way that we're the first messenger, we always look for the one that makes the most sense. And we do research for every project we do. We say, who do you want to hear from? Who do you trust? Who do you listen to? Right. And then we also talk about tactics on, you know, do you get your information from digital or do you want it in person? You know, how do you learn these things? So we spent, you know, a quarter of a century gaining insights into that, and partnerships with the Weather Service, the broadcast meteorology and expertise organizations like you are who people really want to hear these kinds of information updates from. So one in particular, a huge problem is walking or driving into flooded roadways. And years ago, the Weather Service had a warning coordination meteorologist who said, you know, we should just tell people to turn around, don't drown. And we said, gosh, that's a great idea. And they couldn't get it going anywhere. So we developed, in partnership with National Weather Service, we developed the campaign, Turn Around, Don't Drown. We did billboards across Texas in locations that are typically flooded. Texas at the time, and possibly still today, has the most deaths and injuries from flooded roadways where people don't heed that warning. And we've taken that program, it just turned 20. We just had the birthday of Turn Around, Don't Drown. We've taken that program to a place where it's commonly understood, just like stop, drop, and roll for fire. People say, ooh, turn around, don't drown. And it's saved lives. And it's something that we just have to keep repeating. So that partnership, people don't even know that we were a part of that. But I can tell you, if we hadn't partnered with them, the program would have never happened. And it's pretty exciting to see how that occurs. We, you know, people trust their meteorologists. They like their meteorologists. They want to hear from their meteorologists. So they're a critical audience and partner for us in everything that we do.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. And it sounds like you'll come alongside and say, work with those meteorologists that people already trust in their communities. When you said that you were really engaged with people and trying to find out more on, like, where do they get their communication information? Like, where are they seeing this kind of thing? Did you do, like, social science surveys? Like, was there sociology involved? Like, how did you drill down to find out more about how people are receiving their information and where they're getting it from?
So we have done several longer term behavior focused studies. We're actually working on one. We're always working on one. We have one underway right now. One example is after 9/11, the state of Florida asked us to do messaging around domestic security. And we said, you know, we just don't even know where to start. So we received a grant, very significant grant. We worked with Harvard and others, and we did focus groups, qualitative, you know, just talking about things with people. And from the focus groups, you develop good questions, and then you do the kind of verifiable quantitative survey so you can prove that this is what they want. And we use those kinds of studies to backstop everything we do. And then even if it's a smaller campaign, we do surveys and polling because things change and tactics have evolved. We did a big project for 8 years in Disney at Epcot. And people said, well, of course you're successful. You're at Disney World. And we wanted more validation than that. So we did a 1 year follow-on study there with Carnegie Mellon. And we asked people questions and we came back and talked to them a year later. And what we're testing for there is this a good setting? You know, storytelling, is that a good way to get these messages across? And the answer is yes. And how sticky is the message? That's a big thing. Our work requires more than one touch in terms of message, right? It's not a one transaction thing. Please go fix up your roof. Okay, done. No, that's not how it works. We have to make people aware, help them understand how to do it, and then they have to decide yes or no. And then we get to the end goal, which is behavior change. So we test for stickiness. Is this message lasting? Do you recall it? And the next time you see something, are you going to go ahead and take that step? So the research is a really important part of it, and the testing and the polling. And sometimes we have surprises, and then oftentimes we don't. The one thing that always comes through in our whatever level of research we do is that people really do take action and respond when we give them achievable, affordable steps, even if they're baby steps. If we break it down and give you something that you can do today, you're more likely to take action. And it sets you on a path as a homeowner to being aware and thinking, okay, maybe next time I'll do this as well. This year, we did a big focus on garage doors. And the reason we did that is NIST came out with a correlation between protected garage doors and intact roofing and intact sidewalls in high wind events. And it's very much something we've known for 25 years that when the garage door, your largest and weakest opening, when the garage door goes, next goes your roof, right? But thank you, Dr. Mark Levitan and NIST, they did a correlation that validated that. So we're able to say across 3,000 homes and wind speeds up to 135 miles an hour, if you protect that garage door, you've got a great chance of keeping your roof and the adjacent walls. That messaging this year has been so resonant, tremendous feedback about it, because the next piece to that, Hal, is, okay, then I have to give people information on how to protect the garage door, right? And there's a DIY solution that's cost effective. There's a brace that's a little bit of an investment. And then, of course, next time you're getting a garage door, you can pick one that's got all the right things. So I know that's a long answer to that question, but this whole idea of messaging, so often people fail to understand that there's a lot of communication strategy and research that goes into it to make sure that it works. It's not a one-way thing. The people that you're targeting and wanting to talk to, they have to hear you, and then hopefully they'll do something.
Leslie, I love this focus on giving people something that's achievable and affordable, because that empowers them, right? A lot of times when people hear about increasing hurricane hazards or climate change or some of these, the disaster statistics, it's overwhelming, and that can just lead them to be paralyzed, right? If you're giving them achievable, affordable, practical steps they can take for their home, all of a sudden they're like, wow, we can actually implement some of these. When you look at the bird's eye view of someone's home. I mean, could you just take a couple minutes to walk around a bird's eye view in bullet point form? You talked about garage doors are a key focus point. What are some of these other major focus points? If you wanted to say for people the top two or three things they should be thinking about with their homes, you mentioned garage doors. What are one or two other things as well?
Okay, so in high winds, like a hurricane, tornado, or even a severe storm, it's all about keeping the structure intact. So you want to think about the connections, roof to wall, wall to foundation, and there are ways to reinforce those inside the attic and others. And the other piece to high wind is protecting openings, garage doors, windows, doors, even gable end vents and things of that size. The key there is we're keeping those protected so that the wind-borne debris doesn't come break the glass or push in the garage door and allow the house to pressurize. We always describe it like a balloon blowing up. You got to keep that pressure out because if you've seen, and I'm sure you have post-disaster, you've seen houses that look like they exploded from the inside out. That's because the pressure got in via a broken window through some type of opening. And keeping the connections in place is the same thing. When the wind strikes a wall on the side of your house, it's got to go to ground and it's got to run along a continuous load path to dissipate. And if there's any weakness in any of the connections in that load path, the wind and the pressure will exploit it and then you'll see a break. So for high wind, it's openings and connections. For things like wildfire, it's all about ignitability and where those embers land. We've got research now, courtesy of tremendous partners at the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety and other places. Embers can travel up to 2 miles. And when they land, you don't want them to land on something that is going to ignite. So you've got to keep that area around your home devoid of things that can catch fire. Mostly we're talking about plants and other types of materials like wooden decks, and different kinds of ignitable things. So screening, wildfire is actually one of the most affordable things to mitigate from. And there's a whole host of prescriptive steps, screening around the chimney, keeping the embers out from the underside of your deck. And then just in general, not having anything combustible for 0 to 5 feet around your house. So that's a really important one. And flooding is another one. Now flooding is tough, but we always tell people start outside. What understand how the water flows around your house on any, afternoon thunderstorm. Use culverts, landscaping, and other tactics to move water away from your foundation so it doesn't collect and rise into your house. There's a lot you can do there, even just things like keeping your gutters clean, downspouts functional, those things alone, and then understanding the correct use of sandbags when the time comes. And of course, inside your house, it's all about getting things up on a shelf and elevated, having a go bag with your irreplaceable photos or collectibles and things like that. When it comes to earthquake, there's a whole initiative that is called Brace and Bolt. And if you have a home built before a certain vintage of building code in California in the 80s and preceding years, or in many places, unfortunately, if your code is not current, you may need to do this now. But the forces of the earthquake are a little different, where the wind is trying to pull up and pull your roof off. The earthquake is going to move you side to side, right? So you want to brace and or bolt your basement wall so that you don't come off of the foundation. And this is pretty affordable too. Done with plywood and extra bolts, you can stiffen, engineering term, that foundation so it doesn't shake and it doesn't slide and come off. So for every different kind of peril, there's an answer. And there are affordable first steps you can take. There are programs. One of the greatest things happening right now across the country is mitigation programs that states are putting in place. We're very proud of the fact that we designed the first mitigation grant program in Florida in 2005 called My Safe Florida Home. Florida just reinstituted the program and they've now made it recurring. So each and every year here, there will be $200 million worth of $10,000 matching grants for people to harden their home against high wind. People are figuring it out how the whole idea of building performance is really twofold. Either build it right the first time because your building code is current and has all those things in it that you need, or we have to fix up the old stuff. So obviously it's better to do it right the first time, but the challenge now is to get those features onto the older structures before the tornado and before the flood and before the fire.
Leslie, what I love about your message, it sounds like whether it's wind, water, or earthquake, there are action items people can take that sometimes are just really getting to know your property, whether it's tall grass next to a fire-prone area house, or like these braces or different things like that, that people can actually say, hey, these are things I can do to help make my home stronger.
There are. And you know, one of the things our research has always shown is one of the things we have to work to overcome is this notion that when you see that picture, that aerial shot after a disaster and something survived, people tend to think it's luck. So we're always working against that and spreading the message. It's not about luck. It's about something you did on purpose beforehand, either in how your home was built or how you've fixed it or protected it. That's why you survived. So we work really hard to make sure we tell those post-disaster stories. In Hurricane Michael, I bet you saw one house on the beach that withstood the storm. We wanted to add to that story because we don't want people to think that you can only survive if you have a lot of funding, right? And that house that was surviving in the New York Times was very expensive, beautiful that it survived. But we also offered and were successful in advertising the fact that 5 Habitat for Humanity homes survived as well. And those houses were affordable. They were right in the path of the Category 5 storm, and they made it through because they were done intentionally. And even like on the roof, when you think about the roof decking and connecting it, sometimes we're just talking about a box of nails, a couple more boxes of nails, and a closer, denser pattern of nailing. And that's what, in my experience in Hurricane Andrew, one of the fun things we saw in the Miami Herald back then, they had a headline that said Habitat 20, Andrew 0. It was like a football score. And what they're talking about is a little enclave of Habitat homes built by volunteers that survived and was surrounded by commercially developed homes that didn't. And the engineers came in and said, why are these houses here? It was boxes more of nails. That was it. More nails.
Wow. So it sounds like, you know, how much more cost on a house is that, right? Not that much more. And yet just something, quote unquote, small like that can make a huge difference. And I love that concept. We've all seen the Hurricane Michael house that survived. But the idea that you don't need to have, you know, tremendous amount of funds to make a disaster resilient home. It sounds like you're saying some of these smaller, more affordable homes for some people could perform just as well.
Well, and what's fun is, so we have partnerships with like the College of Engineering at UF. That's what the engineering researchers are constantly doing and looking for, is these affordable hacks that lead to resilience. IBHS came out years ago. They had an incidental finding in one of their studies that simply closing your doors before a big windstorm could enhance your ability to withstand the storm. Just closing the doors, because if you think of like a beehive and the cells, it reduced the opportunity for pressurization. So go figure, closing all your doors before the hurricane should become a standard practice for everyone. That costs nothing, right?
Exactly. It's just a practice that we have to hear about and implement. Hey, Leslie, as we close out the podcast here, I wanted to revisit what you mentioned about Disney World. I remember you speaking at the National Tropical Weather Conference, and you said there were some naysayers in the early days saying, you can't take a disaster resiliency message into the happiest place on earth. No one's going to want to hear that. But you did it. You implemented it, and it was successful. Could you just help us understand, like, how did you basically pull that off? It seems like a successful campaign, but when people hear about this, it seems really unlikely or improbable that this would have worked.
Well, and we're kind of famous for tackling the impossible and making it work. And that was one of the examples. So years ago, we had the good fortune to connect with a great partner at the Weather Service and also a Disney exec who, you know, weather devotee. And we talked about how to help the public understand that these points, that there are things you can do that are affordable. And we socialized the concept to the Disney Imagineers. And they said, wait a minute, you mean my house isn't already just right and isn't perfect? And we said, no, not necessarily. They said, okay, we're going to take this on. We need to do something about it. So we came up with this concept called Storm Struck, A Tale of Two Homes. And it was born out of our 2004 Hurricane Charlie experience, where we found two houses and we did news stories with them and created the tale of two homes, right? One side of the street, the older home, the other side of the street, the new building code home, and they had very different outcomes. One destroyed, one survived. And so we came up with a concept to do this. And initially people said, you know, this is too negative and scary for our guests. But what they realized is this was the penultimate empowerment story and the gift of safety. And safety is a Disney value. So we're telling a safety story and helping guests become what, you know, they became the hero of their own storm stories through experiencing Stormstruck. And Stormstruck was opened up. It was 3,000 square feet. And it was a theater experience with 3D glasses. You see a storm. And then through gameplay, you put the neighborhood back together and learn how that, you know, to do that. And then you spill out afterwards into a post-show area where you can go to kiosks and different single topic things, a little game for kids on how to build a kit. We were supposed to be there 2 years. We were held over for 8 because it was the most popular piece in what was called Innoventions, which is where they had what they call, they make up these great words, edutainment experiences. And we had 5.8 million people come through. As I mentioned previously, we brought in Carnegie Mellon to validate our success because we had the body count success. We had the most popular and well-attended experience, but we wanted to see if we were really moving people to understand and take action, and we were. It was really funny. The postdocs and others who worked on the Carnegie Mellon side on the study were kind of shocked at the results of the study and how many people said, oh, I did things differently. I changed things. I choose homes differently. But the Disney storytellers were not surprised at all because the formula, anytime you help people help themselves and you put them in charge of the result, they want to do it. And that's how it worked out. And that's why that's our formula to this day. We want to help you figure out how to fix it and be there with you every step of the way with credible information that saves your family and saves your home.
It sounds like in this messaging at Disney and in everything you do, it's really about empowering people to make choices, get out ahead of these things so that they're not a victim of circumstance, but they actually made choice and had empowerment. And it sounds like that's why that went so well at Disney and in everything y'all do. Leslie, really appreciate you coming on the podcast. There's so much great content here. Our listeners are going to love it. As we wrap up, how can people find y'all online on, you know, if they're just trying to learn more about Flash or how they can partner with you, how can they find you?
We are at flash.org. And we have all our programs are up there. Our information is free. Our counsel is free. So if you have a specific question, go to the site, send it to us. We'll spin it out to our engineers, and we will help you get to that place where you are taking charge of your destiny when it comes to disaster.
Leslie, thanks again for joining us today. We have a forecast for an active hurricane season. I'm hoping these are all fish storms that stay out to sea, but if they're not, I think a lot of people are going to be in a better place because of the work that y'all have done there and your team with Flash. Thanks again for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Wow, what an amazing podcast with Leslie. This episode had so much depth to it. It's the kind of episode you may want to listen to twice or three times to pick up on everything. I love that Leslie provided us with very practical steps that homeowners can take to reduce losses. She gave us a few main bullet points that provide big picture resiliency ideas to combat wind, flood, fire, and earthquake. If you'd like to go deeper with these concepts, visit the Flash website at flash.org. That's FLASH.org, where you can go to a drop-down menu named Perils for more information on those four hazards she mentioned, as well as others like hail, extreme heat, tornadoes, lightning, and winter storms. I wanted to close this podcast with one of the biggest take-home points I got from my conversation with Leslie. Many times residents of disaster-prone areas feel overwhelmed with dire predictions of hyperactive storm seasons, rapid climate change, and billion-dollar disasters in their region. I love that Leslie emphasized the need to give people achievable and affordable action items that they can apply to their home today. As she mentioned in our interview, some of these solutions are not necessarily expensive. They just need homeowners to get out and take some initiative. If you live in a disaster-prone area or work in an industry related to disaster science, keep these words in the front of your mind as well: achievable and affordable. The day after my conversation with Leslie, I was in a hurricane education meeting and was able to apply this concept professionally. Giving people achievable and affordable solutions helps empower them and, like Leslie said, can make them the hero of their own storm stories. Thank you again, Leslie, for taking time to join us on the podcast. A big thanks as well to our marketing team with Blue Leopard Agency, who provide audio engineering and publicity for each podcast episode. And finally, a huge thanks to you, our faithful listeners, who have made the GeoTrek podcast the number one podcast in the topic of natural disasters, according to FeedSpot. Make sure you get outside and enjoy this beautiful summer season, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.